Campus FM presents a talk seminar in the Work in Progress series entitled Georges Bataille's Interpretation of Potlatch and the Gift by Françoise Amit.
Welcome back to the seminar series Work in Progress in the Social Sciences. We had three special seminars in December celebrating the 100th centenary of the publication of Max Weber's seminal work, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. Those were three interesting seminars, the second of which was given by Professor Ursula Apich, who came from Frankfurt University, to give some rather new interpretations of Max Weber. Well, we're back again in the second semester. We have a series of interesting and very different seminars on diverse topics set up for you. Our speaker next week, next Wednesday, March the 29th, will be Christian Hellermann, lecturer in the Anthropology of Migration at the University of Malta. And her topic will be Money for Here and for Home, Economic Strategies of Migrant Women. And she will be discussing and exploring through her own fieldwork the strategies whereby single immigrant women earn money for their families in the home country. Tonight we welcome Françoise Amit, who will be speaking on the very, very interesting topic, the interpretation of potlatch and the gift in the work of the French philosopher and social theorist Georges Bataille. Françoise was an undergraduate in anthropology as well as in philosophy, and now he has begun an MA in philosophy. And it gives us great pleasure to welcome students to give Work in Progress at these seminars. So we very much look forward to what Françoise has to reveal to us, to this whole area of French theory concerning gift exchange, the potlatch, and the economy of waste and of violence. I believe those are some of the topics which Françoise is going to be talking about tonight. Right, Françoise.
First of all, good evening. Thank you very much for this opportunity of being here, and thanks for being here. I was going to start by giving a short biographical note on Georges Bataille, and then continue with the talk. Basically, I chose this quote by Balthus, who was part of the circle of Georges Bataille's circle, who was Pierre Klosowski's brother, who was a collaborator of Bataille. Together they had even published a book, and both of them were deeply rooted in the Nietzschean tradition. Bataille had written on Nietzsche, whereas Klosowski had himself written Nietzsche and the Vicious Circle. Here, although he's discussing a painter, I think it's a very good quote to describe Bataille and his work. A painter can be a realist of the unreal and a figurative of the invisible. The reason being that Bataille is widely known for his concept of the impossible. He goes into searching into totality, a totality which can never be grasped, which is not ideal because it is perfect, but because it is much more than what the human concept can ever grasp, and it goes much more beyond human knowledge. It's actually almost a cosmic theory. Short biographical note, the all work is autobiographical, and Georges Bataille is a personification of this saying. Born in 1897 and dying in 1962, he witnessed some of the greatest turmoils that humanity experienced in all its history. Born to a peasant family in Boulogne, Puy-de-Dôme, he had to witness the horror of existence in the persona of his father, who was blind and suffered from syphilis. Georges himself suffered from tuberculosis, but ironically enough, this was to save him from conscription, although it haunted him for all his life. In his teenage years, he became interested in the Catholic faith, and in 1917, entered the seminary, but he was never to end his studies because in 1920 he lost his faith. His stay in a Benedictine monastery in the Isle of Wight ended when his Catholicism caused a woman he loved to shed tears. This loss of faith made him go deeper into a scholarly world, and in 1922, he got his degree as medieval librarian from the École des Chartes, with a thesis on the order of chivalry told in verse from the 13th century. 1922 is the climax of the changes of the young Bataille. Whilst in Spain on a fellowship he obtained from the School of Advanced Hispanic Studies in Madrid, he witnessed the death of Matador Manuelo Granero during a bullfight. Granero's skull was split open by the horns of the bull. It is a very crude image, but if someone is familiar with Bataille's literature and Bataille's works, all his imagery is very crude. It's actually his way of introducing and enforcing his ideas onto the person and making the person think the way he wants. During the same year, Bataille starts reading Nietzsche, whom he considers as his savior. Here it is important to note that by writing on Nietzsche, Bataille defended Nietzsche's thought and attacked the Nazi appropriation of his thought, and by doing so, he also defended his own thought and beliefs. We could argue that Georges Bataille saw in Nietzsche's intellectual figure an alter ego of himself. In the same year, that is 1922, Bataille obtained a post at the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris, and during this period he immersed himself in the study of philosophy, his greatest influence being Dostoevsky, Kierkegaard and Pascal, but Nietzsche always remained his role model. The 1920s were a period of great psychological turmoil. During this period he wrote The Solar Anus and The Pineal Eye, and he also declared that the French bordellos were his church. 1927 saw him taking psychoanalytic treatment. After this treatment, Bataille was ready to start his intellectual career and his prolific writing. By the same year, he had written some scholarly texts for a high-class and archaeology journal named Aretus. The following year, he married Sylvia Meckels, a young actress. 2 years later, 1930, his daughter Laurence is born, but by 1934, the couple is no more. Sylvia will later become the wife of Jacques Lacan. 1930 sees the publication of the novel The Story of the Eye, under the pseudonym of Lord Auk, and in the same year, he becomes Secretary General of the Journal Document. Here Bataille starts writing some of his ideas, like the formulas and the importance of aesthetics. This is the period when the intellectual war against Breton is at its peak, with Breton writing insulting comments against Bataille in the Second Surrealist Manifesto, and Bataille insulting him back in the work A Corpse. 1931 sees the end of Document, but it is here that we find the development of the Bataille that I shall be presenting you with. I shall be presenting you with in my paper. During this period, he attends the lectures of Marcel Mauss, and he reads the works of Hegel, Marx, Trotsky, Stirner, and Marquis de Sade. It is these readings that will give a political side to the dissident surrealists of whom Bataille is a member. Bataille starts giving shape to his economic theories, a case in point being his article on the notion of expenditure. By 1935, Bataille felt that the communist and socialist parties had betrayed the revolutionary ideas that had attracted him so much. After a reconciliation with Breton, a new surrealist group is formed, Contre-Attaque. The year after, this group was already on the mortuary list, and Bataille, resolute as ever, formed another group, the College of Sociology. This advocated an activist sociology. He also founded an esoteric secret society, of which little is known, apart from his symbolic logo, which is the one here, a headless man. In 1938, he also tried setting up a society for collective psychology, with psychoanalysts Adrien Borel and René Allendy. But World War II brought an end to all this. The warriors saw Bataille withdrawing in himself and even starting to practice yoga. During this period, he writes his most introspective works like Inner Experience. And by the end of the war, he has published his most influential works, that is, Der Kircher and Don Nietzsche. These years are also marked by the aggravating state of his tuberculosis. By now, Bataille has affirmed himself as an intellectual. In 1946, he founds the Journal Critique, which is still published today, and even starts giving lectures as a visiting lecturer. In the same year, he remarries to Diane de Beauharnais, who will give birth to a daughter named Julie. Between 1949 and 1958, Bataille will publish a large number of works, ranging from a book about the cave painting of de Lascaux to the novel Blue of Noon. Although he enjoys this intellectual success, financial problems are never to leave his doorstep. This problem is only alleviated in 1961 when artists like Picasso, Miró, and Ernst will make an auction to collect money to allow Bataille some financial security. In the same year, his last work is published, Tears of Eros. Unfortunately, Bataille will die the following year, but with his death comes an unprecedented intellectual success. In fact, many thinkers owe much to his thought, people like Foucault, Solers, and Derrida, to mention but a few. Most of things, to add another thing, is most of these authors were contributors to the journal Tel Quel. Now, this is my paper, and basically I'm going to be discussing and analyzing the way that Bataille goes through the work of Marcel Mauss, The Gift, and the way he interprets it, and through it gives a clear depiction of what his economic theories are. Marcel Mauss' work, The Gift, has been very influential in the social sciences because it managed to analyze a very crucial aspect of human activities in a manner that was innovative and unthought of. He managed to uncover what lies behind the scenes of a seemingly disinterested action. Georges Bataille, on his part, draws from Mauss' work information that is essential to the creation and development of his economic theories that are far from conventional in the eyes of many. It is my aim to analyze Bataille's theories, especially in the light of the well-known work by Mauss. By comparing and contrasting these two authors and drawing from other influences, I hope to give a clear picture of key ideas normally associated to Bataille's thought. Key ideas like sovereignty, excess, and sacrifice. It is also my intention to do this in the light of Western society and the rituals that exist within it. Particularly, I shall be looking at Maltese cultural activities as a source of information to explain the Bataillean economic theories that have been mentioned. Maltese society is in its way a modern Western society, but within it there are still strong traces of a pre-capitalist society. Maltese traditions and rituals would fall into, quote, the long tradition of anti-capitalist thought within the capitalist West. Ambivalence towards capitalism has a long tradition in Europe. This was from The Devil, Satanism, and the Evil Eye in Contemporary Malta by John P. Mitchell from The Powers of Good and Evil. Gift-giving in society. In our daily lives, we constantly experience the importance of gifts and gift-giving. Every memorable moment in our lives is marked by the ritual or tradition of gift-giving. In Maltese society, we receive gifts on the day of our baptism, Holy Communion, confirmation, marriage, birthdays, some are important than others, example 13, 18, or 21, which are a sort of coming of age, and for example graduation, to mention but a few. Other events of gift giving happen, but these are more on a personal level than on a social level. In other societies, we find the same type of occurrences happening throughout the life of an individual and his community. Their title or the event per se would be different, but essentially they would be the same. Example, confirmation, the Catholic confirmation, would be replaced by a ritual that marks the stage of puberty and in which the individual is turned into a full member of a society. The essential aspect of all the events that have been mentioned before is the fact that they all delineate the most crucial stages of a person's life. Apart from that, there is the element that not only the development is a personal one, but also a social one. With every stage reached, the individual not only grows as an individual, but also as a member of his or her society. With every stage, one's role in society changes, and the level of immersion into the social framework increases. Therefore, we see that the gift on these happenings is a sign of acceptance and recognition by the fellow members of society. But for the receiver, the acceptance of the gift is a sign that the person is accepting the responsibilities and duties that are being bestowed on him or her. An element that makes these events even more important is the ritual that is linked to them. Ritual practices are tied to all these important stages in the development of the person as a member of society. Not only is there a spiritual ritual system, but also an economic one. The religious aspect of most of these events gives a validity to them that goes beyond their material aspect. By being religious occurrences, they are given a transcendental meaning that makes them essential for the existence of the person. The economic part is the aspect of expenditure and how this influences recognition from the part of the other members of society. Thus, we can note that these gift-giving happenings are both a spiritual experience and also a socio-economic experience. By spiritual, I mean an inner experience that denotes a development or change in the personality and character of the person. This is why Bataille only manages to discuss his economic theories in conjunction to his concepts of inner experience. This shall be explained and developed further at a later stage. However, I shall now be giving an example to try and better illustrate the point. The First Holy Communion is one of the most important events in the life of a Catholic. Through the receiving of this sacrament, which is somewhat more of a ritual than anything else, one obtains another rite, thus becoming more involved in the Catholic community. In fact, the child undergoes a long preparation, practically commencing at the time that it learns how to talk, before the conferring of this rite is carried out. Through doctrine lessons, the child is taught both the dictates of the Catholic faith, which in the majority of both the dictates of the Catholic faith and those of society. Most of the times, these overlap each other. To put it into Freudian terms, the age of seven is the stage where to society, the child has to start controlling his id by a well-developed superego. Society gives a religious significance to its own rules. This aspect is a clear example of why functionalism defines religion as a worship of society. Apart from the religious ritual that occurs, that is the church ceremony, there is also a socio-economic aspect that goes on. The dresses that the children wear, the photographers that are hired to immortalize the moment, and the parties that are held by the families for the other acquaintances and the other members of the family. These are all signs of the notion of expenditure as a mode of social recognition. By investing in the dress of the child, the family is trying to outdo other families and confirm their social standing within society. By holding a huge family party, the family is manifesting its economic power and social standing. The families that are invited are in turn obliged to return the favor and are obliged to gift a gift that is appropriate for the occasion if they don't want to lose face and be seen on a lesser social scale. To Georges Bataille, these aspects are the sign of a sovereign type of behavior, a behavior that communicates through excess and activities of unproductive behavior. Paradoxically, this is what shows the divine aspect in humanity. Sovereignty is an inner experience, and the spiritual part of a person, in this case a religious experience, is manifested and communicated to the other members of society through economic aspects. Expenditure gives a meaning to that which cannot be necessarily explained. Through economic means, a non-material aspect is being defined. In this presentation, I shall be arguing in favor of Bataille's theories, just as Tozick did, quoting from John Pimich's introduction to the book The Powers of Good and Evil. Tozick has argued that it was, above all, Georges Bataille who gave us an understanding of the relationship between morality and economics, defining it as entwining excess and transgression so as to create a radically different history and science of political economy, capitalism and communism. Bataille can be classified within the limits of any of the usual schools of thought, that is Marxism, functionalism or Weber's Protestant ethic. He draws ideas from the three of them, and adds to this concoction about a Bataillean tinge that makes his theory so original and non-conformist. Bataille draws from functionalism the concept that human activities serve a social function, and that these are part of the social framework. He agrees that events like the potlatch play a vital role within the social structure, and that these are essential elements to its existence. But he also argues that functionalism has a mishap, because it only analyzes social phenomena in relation to ends and utility. According to Bataille, functionalism looks at social events as, on the one hand, this material utility is limited to acquisition, in practice to production, and to the conservation of good. On the other, it is limited to reproduction and to the conservation of human life. This was taken from Visions of Excess. Functionalism can only look at expenditure and consumption as a means of survival or as a way that leads to further productivity. In his work, Bataille argues that this perspective of consumption is only one aspect of it. He is interested in another aspect of consumption. As you can see here, the second part is represented by so-called unproductive expenditures. Luxury, mourning, war, cults, the construction of sumptuary monuments, games, spectacles, arts, perverse sexual activity, that is deflected from genital finality, all these represent activities which, at least in primitive circumstances, have no end beyond themselves. Therefore, in this paper, the notion of expenditure shall only be applied to this type of activities. To Bataille, expenditure is the most important aspect of humanity. This notion of non-use value is the essence of being human. In Tears of Eros, he argues that the rise of art came along with the knowledge of death. To Bataille, art is a non-use value activity, and the consciousness of death is what distances man from animality. Therefore, the development of expenditure and culture are parallel to each other. In the evolving thought of Georges Bataille, we find that for a period of time, he was a supporter of Marxism, especially taking into consideration the turmoil of his times. He was not a Marxist, though. He molded its theories to develop his own theories and concepts. To him, expenditure is an activity that detaches and separates the poor from the power structures. In order to maintain this preeminence, since power is exercised by the classes that expend, poverty was excluded from all social activity. And the poor have no other way of re-entering the circle of power than through the revolutionary destruction of the classes occupying that circle. In other words, through a bloody and in no way limited social expenditure. As you can see from Bataille's words, expenditure can easily take a violent form. In actual fact, all forms of expenditure are a manifestation of the violent forces inherent within us. Without these manifestations, war and violence would be the constant state of life experienced by human societies and individuals. This violent aspect is experienced constantly by the participants of the potlatch. The potlatch is a way of redirecting the energies of the warring clans and using their rivalry in other ways that is not direct war. Very violent and destructive forces may be rife in the potlatch, like the sacrifice of slaves, burning of canoes, and throwing copper ingots of great value into the sea. But this destruction is not only a way of redirecting the destructive forces, but I argue that destruction and sacrifice accentuate class struggle. In potlatch, the chief is giving away or destroying objects that have been obtained from poorer individuals. In one's outdoing of a rival, the individual is further distancing himself from the poor and destitute members of his society. The rich man consumes the poor man's losses, creating for him a category of degradation and abjection that leads to slavery. Now, it is evident that from the endlessly transmitted heritage of this sumptuary world, the modern world has received slavery and reserved it from the proletariat. This is evident in our contemporary world when we see the useless luxury of billionaires and Hollywood stars. Through their senseless and useless expenditures of wealth, they manage to elevate themselves to stardom to such an extent that they are revered almost as deities. Most rulers and powerful individuals or groups have made their power evident and felt through luxury and overspending. Very clear examples of Western society would be Caligula and Louis XIV. Thus we can see that the expenditure can turn into very violent forms when it is a manifestation of class struggle. This happens not only from the part of the wealthy in their destruction of property, but, quote, the grandest form of social expenditure, unquote, happens when class struggle is taken up by the workers and the lower social classes. This expenditure can easily threaten the very existence of the master classes, as we have seen in the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution. Revolt is the most extreme form of social change that can occur. But another very strong form of social change is Christianity. In The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, Weber argued that capitalism developed because of the way of thought and the ideals held by Calvinists. In the uncertainty whether one belonged to the elect or not, individuals tried to live ascetic lives because in this way they managed to convince themselves that they were part of the elect. This meant that contrary to the aristocratic classes, the new bourgeoisie families didn't spend their wealth in useless behavioral purchases. They reinvested their profits. Expenditure is frowned upon. Bataille agrees with this view of Christianity, but here we find that he has an ambivalent relationship to it. He argues in the same manner as Weber did, that is, that the new bourgeoisie families were against expenditure and that they reinvested their money in order to increase their profits. But to Bataille, this was not a sign of an ascetic life but of hypocrisy. He argues that their profits were reinvested so as to hide them from the ruling aristocracy. Quote, as the class that possesses the wealth, having received with wealth the obligation of functional expenditure, the modern bourgeoisie is characterized by the refusal in principle of this obligation. It has distinguished itself from the aristocracy through the fact that it has consented only to spend for itself and within itself. In other words, by hiding its expenditures as much as possible from the eyes of the other classes. I would suppose that being a Marxist at heart, although not agreeing fully to it, made Bataille prejudiced against the bourgeoisie and their rule. In fact, he even describes them as, quote, incapable of concealing a sordid face, a face so rapacious and lacking in nobility. On the other hand, Bataille believed that Christianity, especially early Christianity and medieval Christianity, was a means of social change in favor of the poorer social classes. Here we see this ambivalence that Bataille is coming from a Catholic tradition, whereas Weber was coming from a Protestant tradition. So there's this different perspective of Christianity. Through Christian myths and imagery, the rules of potlatch that created division were reversed against the ruling classes. The rules of potlatch were changed so that gifts were now turned into alms for the poor. Thus, we realize that Bataille fully agrees with Mauss' description and interpretation of alms to the poor in relation to the rules of gift giving. Quote, alms are the fruits of a moral notion of the gift, and of fortune on the one hand, and of a notion of sacrifice on the other. Generosity is an obligation, because Nemesis avenges the poor and the gods for the superabundance of happiness and wealth of certain people who should rid themselves of it. This is the ancient morality of the gift, which has become a principle of justice. This is where we find Bataille's critique of the bourgeoisie, where he mentions that with luxury and with wealth comes the obligation of expenditure. Here it has been changed with a notion of the obligation to give alms. Bataille recognizes and gives Christianity another power that it bestows on the poor in their class struggle. Through Christian imagery of the horrors of existence, these poorer classes have refuted the legitimacy of the expenditure of the ruling classes. Christians managed to change the rules of potlatch the other way around. Quote, thus, independently of oratory reforms, an exchange of exasperated challenges was established, exacerbated above all by the poor. A potlatch in which we refuse and refilled more refilled entered into a rivalry of horrible grandeur with everything in the world that was rich, pure and brilliant. Unquote. In other words, the poorer classes managed to take out the fun from the practices of expenditure that the rich practiced. In this way, ruining all the pleasure for the ruling classes and creating a sense of disgust and nausea. This is what common English would call sour grapes. As we can see, Bataille accepts the way Weber outlined the way Christianity changed the social structures of society. But his conclusions are slightly different. Here I would be audacious enough to say that Bataille's conclusions show that he was influenced from, as I was saying before, from a Catholic worldview and not a Calvinist one. In his analysis of economy and the social structures, Bataille constantly draws information from Mauss the gift. To Bataille, the phenomenon of the potlatch is a total phenomenon, and that includes within it all the aspects of society that we are presently interested in. Potlatch manages to show a relation between culture, religion, and economy, to say the least. Marcel Mauss the gift. For a long period of time, information was being gathered so that the development of economic systems could be traced. Most economic theories propose that barter was the form of commerce adopted by primitive societies, but Mauss disagreed with this and outlined a much more complex system of exchange of resources. He argued that gift-giving was the economic system found in many primitive societies, and that this was the principal movement of goods within these communities and between them. The information he gathered showed that the system was widespread in most of the world. Mauss presents us with a complex system of exchange that would be hard to understand from a contemporary economic point of view. Gift-giving activities always seemed disinterested and selfless, but in reality, this was only the surface strata of complex total social phenomena. Mauss argues that in these total social phenomena, as we propose calling them, all kinds of institutions are given expression at one and the same time. Religious, juridical, and moral, which relate to both politics and the family. Likewise, economic ones, which suppose special forms of production and consumption, or rather, of performing total services and distribution. This is not to take into account the aesthetic phenomena to which these facts lead, and the contours of the phenomena that these institutions manifest. Here, it is important to understand that not all gift-giving institutions are the same. This distinction is not made according to cultural or religious differences, but because gift-giving institutions may take more violent, agonistic forms that shall be termed by Mauss as potlatch. This is a term used by some North American tribes found on the northwestern coast, and Mauss gives us a clean-cut definition of what the term potlatch will be referring to in his work. Quote, "But within these two tribes of the American Northwest and throughout this region, there appeared what is certainly a type of these total services, rare but highly developed. We propose to call this form the potlatch. The word potlatch essentially means to feed, to consume." Bottom of the quote, the bold one. "Yet, what is noteworthy about these tribes is the principle of rivalry and hostility that pervades in all these practices. They go as far as to fight and kill chiefs and nobles. Moreover, they even go as far as the purely sumptuary destruction of wealth that has been accumulated in order to outdo the rightful chief as well as his associate. We propose to reserve the term potlatch for this kind of institution that, with less risk and more accuracy, but also at greater length, we might call total services of an agonistic type." Close quote. The elements of rivalry, combat, and destruction are what distinguish potlatch from other forms of gift-giving. And it is these elements that have fascinated Mauss and the academic world, including Bataille. This violent aspect that is associated to these activities is hard to understand. And behind them lie the most disturbing and intrinsic aspects of human behavior and social behavior. It is important to note that Bataille finds in the potlatch all the elements he needs for formulating and presenting his economic theories. To Bataille, the violent and destructive forces present in the potlatch are the same forces that move the world and bring about change. One of the basic elements of Durkheim's theory of religion is the distinction he creates between profane objects and sacred objects. This distinction is the power of the potlatch. The rivalry between the nobles and chiefs wouldn't be so manifest if the objects that are being exchanged were considered to be profane objects. The institution of the potlatch is so strong and so sought after because the objects that are offered as gifts are sacred. Souls are mixed with things, things with souls. It is this very sacredness that makes reciprocity essential to the survival of the participants of the potlatch. Quote, "The Taonga are implored to destroy the individual who has accepted them. Thus, they contain within them that force, in cases where the law, particularly the obligation to reciprocate, may fail to be observed." Close quote. Therefore, we can see that gift-giving is not only a way of exerting power over a rival, or a way of increasing wealth. But the enemy himself can actually be destroyed through the potlatch. If a rival fails to reciprocate a gift within a stipulated period of time, devastating effects may ensue. It must also be noted that the gift must be reciprocated with interest. In Potlatch, it is not only the honor and glory of the chiefs that are at stake, but even their own lives and the lives of their own clans and people. Mao stresses this point by analyzing the way Potlatch is viewed by the people that practice it. He points out to the fact that the Tlingit and the Tsimshian look at the ritual destruction of property as a killing of property, and they consider the Potlatch a war, even referring to its rituals as a war dance. This concept of killing property is very important in our considerations of the Potlatch. As mentioned before, the act of gift-giving is so strong because the objects exchanged are sacred. They possess a spirit and a life of their own. This means that these living objects are suitable enough to become sacrifices. Gods are worthy only of the most important gifts. Living property in other words, which would take the form of slaves and animals most of the times. Maus argues that the destruction of property developed into a form of sacrifice to the gods. To him, this was a natural development. By considering the objects of gift-giving as living, these objects became worthy enough so as to become sacrifices. Maus traces a development from the potlatch towards sacrifice, and at a later stage towards contract sacrifice. This evolution was a natural one. One of the first groups of beings with which men had to enter into contract, and who, by definition, were there to make a contract with them, were above all the spirits of both the dead and of the gods. Indeed, it is they who are the true owners of the things and possessions of this world. With them, it was most necessary to exchange, and most dangerous not to exchange. Yet conversely, it was with them it was easiest and safest to exchange. The purpose of destruction by sacrifice is precisely that it is an act of giving that is necessarily reciprocated. Later on he adds, It is evident that here a start can be made on formulating a theory and history of contract sacrifice. Contract sacrifice supposes institutions of the kind that we have described. And conversely, contract sacrifice realizes them to the full, because those gods who give and return gifts are there to give a considerable thing in the place of a small one. At this point, it is now I'm going to give Bataille's interpretation of the gift and his own economic theories. At this point, it is necessary to understand what Bataille's economic theories are. We are used to the classical interpretations of economy, which usually only analyze the relationship between production and consumption. In this scenario, consumption is only regarded as a means of increasing production. In other words, consumption is only viewed as a means to an end, and not as an end in itself. Bataille's theory of general economy goes against this economic view, and by looking at a wider angle shows how consumption can be an end to itself and that consumption is essential to the survival of society. Bataille's economic theories cannot be separated from his other systems of thought. The principles he uses for his economics are the same principles he uses in all his arguments. General economy seeks to analyze and describe a totality that goes beyond immediate human economy, just as his theory of the impossible goes beyond rationality and human thought. General economy is an economics of the social ecology of drives. Therefore, what are these drives that bind human actions and regulate economy? Quote, I will begin with a basic fact. The living organism, in a situation determined by the play of energy on the surface of the globe, ordinarily receives more energy than is necessary for maintaining life. The excess energy, wealth, can be used for the growth of a system, example, another organism. If the system can no longer grow, or if the excess cannot be completely absorbed in its growth, it must necessarily be lost without profit. It must be spent, willingly or not, gloriously or catastrophically. Close quote. This was from the Acherscher, Volume 1. These are the same rules that have led to development of eroticism. Whereas before sexual intercourse was only viewed as a means of reproduction, an increase in wealth changed this view. Excess energy had to be used, but this had to be done in a non-material use manner. Thus, sovereignty was expressed through a sexual act that only led to pleasure and no material end. This would be called eroticism. Here it is important to note that the phenomenon of potlatch existed among particular tribes and not others because of their wealth. Mouse himself describes his American Northwest Indians as very rich. This wealth was excessive and had to be expended in some manner or another. History has shown us that art and non-productive activities, example philosophy in ancient Greece, have only developed in societies that were passing through strong and economic growth and periods of relative stability. Stability is also a key element because a state of warfare would use the excess energy towards the war effort. In the Akers share, we find that Bataille has laid down his theory of general economy. He first analyzes how ecological systems develop, and from these he extrapolates principles that are applicable to human societies and environments. It is important to understand that the most basic elements in general economy are the ideas of limits and excess. A society cannot keep on expanding in an unlimited manner. It is restricted by space and resources. These limitations will create excess production and energy. In some way or other, these must be consumed, wastefully, or maybe in a way that helps extending these limits. These limits create pressure on a society, pressure that is felt by its members and that will create a tension among these same individuals. This pressure leads towards two effects. Firstly, extension, and then towards squander or luxury. A people will first of all try to use excessive energy and production to try and extend the boundaries, example, by cutting down a forest to create more habitable land. If this does not work or the pressure increases, there may be two types of results. Either internal strife will occur and the excess is consumed in the destruction of certain individuals, thus creating more space, or else the excess is used in a non-productive manner, in other words, uselessly. The excess is consumed in luxuries. In turn, these luxuries are divided into two types of luxuries, natural or man-made. Nature's luxuries are eating, death, and sexual reproduction, whilst man created new forms of luxury, like the arts, eroticism, complex religious rituals and systems, or in a more destructive manner, war. War is an orgy of consumption of excess energy that would have been accumulating for a very, very long time. Potlatch manages to consume excess energy that would probably be redirected towards war if this institution did not exist. Potlatch manages to consume excess towards extending the power and limits of a tribe or chief, but it is also the useless consumption of excess energy and produce. Quote, indifferent to intentions, to reticences and lies, slowly or suddenly, the movement of wealth exudes and consumes the resources of energy. This often seems strange, but not only do these resources suffice, if they cannot be completely consumed productively, a surplus usually remains, which must be annihilated. At first sight, potlatch appears to carry out this consumption badly. The destruction of riches is not its rule. They are ordinarily given away, and the loss in the operation is reduced to that of the giver. The aggregate of riches is preserved, but this is only an appearance. If potlatch rarely results in acts similar in every respect to sacrifice, it is nonetheless the complementary form of an institution whose meaning is in the fact that it withdraws wealth from productive consumption. In general, sacrifice withdraws useful products from profane circulation. In principle, the gifts of potlatch liberate objects that are useless from the start. The withdrawing of wealth from productive consumption is what is meant by the term useless. A diamond placed on a ring has lost its use value when it is only used as a precious jewel. Its power of acquisition is sacrificed for a useless reason. In Tears of Eros, Bataille's thus published work, he uses these economic theories to analyze the development of society and how art developed in conjunction to it. his insight as a useless consumption of excess resources, but simultaneously to the development of art and art forms, he traced the development of destructive means of consumption, like torture and slavery. The expenditure of excess resources is both constructive and destructive. As argued in his essay, The Hatred of Poetry, excessive energy like hatred can lead either to violence or to poetry. In both these instances, passion and energy is so strong and involving that the individual who is acting in a state of sovereignty comes closer to the impossible. This is also found in the potlatch. The destruction of artifacts and goods brings the participants closer to the world of the spirits of their ancestors. Georges Bataille tried to come up with a post-Marxist economic theory that incorporated other systems of thought. The potlatch was perfect, since it was a total system that incorporated the most crucial aspects of human society, like religion, power, and economy. To add to this, just as Mauss argued in his conclusion, potlatch, or gift-giving, is a widespread phenomenon that can be found in many societies that seem so diverse from each other. To close my paper, and maybe give some points for a further discussion, I identified some elements which I would regard as similar to those that we would find in the potlatch, but these are for a particular community of the Moisés society, who are the panthers of the Marsa racetracks. One of these is that the potlatch has an element of gambling that is even mentioned by Mauss himself. Secondly, wealth is spent on luxuries like ridiculously large gold rings to show status. The lending of money, not as a loan, is seen as a test of manhood, and it must be reciprocated with interest in order to show gratitude. Losses are part of the collective and personal memory more than winnings. Losses become the subject of stories and boasting. Virility is shown by the amount of money or wealth that a panther is ready to gamble, sometimes even challenging each other openly. If the other panther does not have the expenditure power to play that much, then he will lose face publicly.
Thank you very much, François, for an extremely wide-ranging argument. You've moved from Marx to Marcel Mauss. You've brought in, by contrast, Max Weber. In discussing Bataille, you've referred to the sacred and profane in Durkheim. And then you've gone into some detail in trying to pinpoint what makes the economy of consumption or extravagant fundamentally different from the economy of production, preservation, saving, if you will. So that here we have a whole series of contrasts which you've outlined. And on top of that, you sought to exemplify this by references to practices very much close to our own reality in Malta. I wonder what questions the audience has to make. I know I have as many questions about Bataille from your very interesting overview of his life and his thought as I do about his actual theory of the gift. But perhaps we should begin by asking the audience what questions immediately come to their mind.
I'm a literature. Although I haven't read Bataille, I'm working on a similar aspect of a similar aspect to what you've discussed today, because I'm discussing the notion of the gift in relation to the contemporary novelist Christine Brooke Rose's work. However, I'm taking it, although I do discuss Mauss in my work, I'm trying to view it from the perspective of Derrida. Derrida discusses Mauss is the gift in his own work, Counterfeit Money, and discusses how the notion of the gift can actually escape cycles of return and exchange. Now, you spoke about excess and expenditure, and you linked it to eroticism, which is something that I am discussing myself also, and you also linked it to poetry. I was wondering whether you could comment about elements of madness in Bataille. I'm trying to link in my own work the notion of the gift and the notion of... Derrida discusses the gift not as something that can be returned or that participates in a return or in an exchange, but as that element that can escape exchange, the one thing that can escape cycles of reciprocity. I try to link this in my own work with the exchange of women as discussed by Levi-Strauss, the notion that women are exchanged between men. I am trying to link this notion of exchange to the notion of the gift and trying to show how true madness, for example, true writing, true poetry, true eroticism, women can escape this exchange between men. I was wondering whether you could comment about notions of madness, maybe. I haven't read Bataille, but I've read some elements about Bataille, mm-hmm. and I know that it is linked to madness in some way.
Yeah, there are elements where he discusses madness, mostly Foucault's. But I mean, Derrida is actually very much influenced by Bataille himself. Madness and women, particularly, even just madness. Put it this way, in this case, since we would be discussing literature, I wouldn't refer that much to his economic theories, but I would more go into either his aesthetic theories or his own literature. I mean, that is actually my thesis. I'm doing Nietzsche and Bataille and analyzing their aesthetic theories and the way it's linked to morality and how madness is a way of going beyond morality and actually destroying morality so as to create a new sense of morality. The fact that, for example, Bataille wrote a lot of erotic novels, I don't know, Story of the Eye, for example, or Madame Edwarda, well, they are not just pure erotic novels. There is madness in them, especially a Story of the Eye, where there is this certain fascination with the eye itself. The eye is an object, the eye is a metaphor, the eye is a fetish object. First of all, he probably uses the eye because of his influence from surrealism and him being a part of surrealism.
What is the name of that novel again, please?
The Story of the Eye. So, you know, like, even surrealism itself, there's already this concept of madness. Madness creates... I would say that the way of evading, as you were mentioning, evading the system, is that madness manages to create links and relationships which are normally not there. So, if someone is usually brought to think of A equals B, through madness, you can say that A is equal to Z. Because it goes against it, it goes beyond. That is actually what surrealism is. That is what Derrida most of the times does in his work. I mean, when he analyzes a piece of work, and the pharmacon, the concept of the pharmacon itself, it's where exactly, precisely. So when you have this thing of madness, you know, like by creating a different relationship to something or to another, I don't know, taking it in this concept of Bataille's concept of the gift, by managing to use this excessive energy in a means of unproductivity. I'm going against certain notions of productivity, what is creating this sense of sovereignty. I am powerful enough to own this energy. I am powerful enough to not be dictated by the higher classes of society to do with this energy. So instead of, you know, like investing certain money or certain goods in a productive manner, I just decide, you know, like to go on a drinking binge. For Bataille, that is an act of sovereignty. And, you know, like, that's why there is all this murder and violence and linked to madness, because the madman, he is the master of himself. I mean, how can I explain? The jester in the court of the king is the only person that can tell the king the reality. He can go up to the king and tell him he's a fool. He's the only one, but he's mad, he can do it. And probably that is even what you find in Madness and Civilization by Foucault. Don't know if I answered.
There's also the point in Tears of Eros, if I remember correctly, that when he's discussing the Hellenic period, he says that Dionysiac rituals involved the destruction of human beings, involved a mad surge of energy, which reached its height in the destruction, for example, of infants. When people were possessed by the spirit, they did this, which suggests again a link between madness and the divine in the thought of Georges Bataille.
In classical civilizations, both Greek and Roman, basically, apart from the Dionysian festivals, which are probably very well known, even because of Nietzsche, when he discusses the Dionysian aspect in his Birth of Tragedy. But there was also the Saturnalia, which carnival is probably the descendant of the Saturnalian festivals of those times, where basically all rules of rationality were forgotten. Irrationality, complete chaos, those were the rule.
To a certain boundary as well.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
It wasn't totally ignored. There were certain limits, like a certain boundary of ethics. Not ethics, but code of behavior.
Not complete.
How, I don't know if it's relevant, he was, I believe, called the metaphysician of evil, Bataille.
Uh-huh.
But there was some sort of ethical discourse. How would you link it with his theories of the economic?
Basically, the discourse of evil is that, how can I explain? Discourse of evil is not that he believes that evil is good. It's not a reversal. It's just that evil, by doing evil, you are showing this sign of sovereignty, the same type of sovereignty that we have been mentioning in the economic theories. And where you are, how can I explain? That, for example, within the sphere of the arts, which is this useless activity within the sphere of the arts, evil is something which is essential. It's not something which can be used, which is practically essential. I mean, in the essay, The Hatred of Poetry, there is this thing where he gives this, he makes hatred become a value which is so important. And, you know, like, with true hatred, because you hate something, you can create certain artistic things. I mean, most literature has probably created from it. Hatred, evil, concept of evil. I mean, Nietzsche, for example, and Bataille in Tears of Eros, argue that the Dionysian was the chaotic manner of how the Dionysian was expressed is a way for the human mind how to express and understand the chaos of living. I mean, even people who are not, you know, like, I don't know, like, for example, Sartre. Sartre didn't like what I read as well. I mean, nausea. Nausea is, I mean, it's basically the chaos of existence. There is the sickness of existence. And to Bataille, events like evil and hatred and these strong chaotic feelings are a way of expressing and of understanding the chaos of existence and like death in itself. That's why in Tears of Eros he conjoins the idea of the consciousness of death with the rise of art, because through the consciousness of death there was this thing that kind of, but why do we die? Exactly.
We wouldn't have arts. We were immortal. We wouldn't need art.
Precisely.
Can you explain that more? That was the point in the talk where I was trying to follow and didn't grasp the argument. This idea that the consciousness of death is the awareness of culture or the experience of culture. That Levi Strauss creates his own dividing line between nature and culture, whereas I understand for Bataille it's a different one. The consciousness of death is the moment of art. I'm not following here.
From the little I've read, I think because it's a realization that you need something to transcend.
Firstly, in Bataille there is a distinction between nature and nurture. As I was mentioning, the concept of limits, he takes it from nature. I mean, as we know, if you have a certain biosphere, a certain ecology, there's limitations because the environment will change and the animals are not evolved for that system, so there are limits and there will be pressure and all this stuff. This same rule, he applies to human society. And basically, this same principle which animals follow, this animality, this animalism, is still inherent within human beings. But through our consciousness of death, we became self-conscious. Because we know that someday we're going to die, we created an identity. Because we know that the time is limited and that within that span of time, there is a sense within us of that we have to do something. And just waking up in the morning, working and going back to sleep, waking up in the morning, working and going to sleep, you know, like, it makes that even more senseless. It doesn't give a meaning to that. Whereas, if I know that, all right, I have 20 years of living, but within those 20 years, I had excess energy to waste on luxury. I had my moments of pleasure, my moments of deep passion, of deep emotions, like hatred and... like hatred, for example, or evil. Therefore, death can be understood. Because, all right, there's death, but at least the bit of time that there was lived, I gave a meaning to it. But where, if I, without the consciousness of death, you know, like you just wake up in the morning, then at a certain point you're just there, no longer there.
I think going back to the... idea of consciousness through death and forming the art, what I understand is that when we get conscious from the age or any moment when we are alone, we are thinking of death, somehow it brings pain. And a human mind, I think it finds very difficult to just think that we are going to finish one day. We are no more there. So I believe, it's just my own thinking, that probably through creating art, we are trying to perpetuate our existence. It's like psychologically we know that even after we are dead in our body, there is something behind us. Probably it can be linked to reproduction, having kids. The urge behind our minds is actually to perpetuate our existence through them. So probably art is a sort of a desire for our own perpetuation, to feel that we are not going to be just finished. There is something, our own extension, I think.
Mm-hmm. A sense of immortality.
Yeah.
But that would be more a Platonic idea.
What about the society, like in India, where death is not the end? I mean, you have different lives. And I think for them, the limit is more between the limit, you know, your limit is the death. For them, the limit could be between the individuals and the cosmos. And in doing art, they try to be into the cosmos, to participate with, I don't know, but that's a suggestion.
Put it this way, but still, there is still a limit. Although they believe in an afterlife, for example, for the Hindus or the Buddhists, take Eastern religions, for them there is a limit. There is death, but there is an afterlife, so it's not as such a... But it's still a limit, because when you are reborn, you are not the same person. You are a different identity. So, at least I'm not saying that I'm correct or anything, because it's not that mentioned that much, but... And there's this notion that the you have a different identity, therefore there is a death per se. There is a stop, and there's a the continuation is not a complete continuation, there's still a change. It's like basically the child that dies to become the adolescent, who dies to become the man, that constant change.
One interesting thing, now that you mention Indian religion, is that, for example, if one reads Hermann Hesse's rendering of Hindu religion in Siddhartha, it's very interesting toward the end of that book, where distinctions between good and evil completely collapse. We know in his final vision, Siddhartha just imagines a world in which good and evil collapse. You mentioned that Taussig, the anthropologist Taussig, was influenced by Bataille. Well, you know that in The Devil and Commodity Fetishism in South America, Michael Taussig is really concerned to point out that the Indian religion of the Aymara of South America was not based on a distinction between a category called good and a category called evil. There was rather a constant process of growth, destruction, and balance. The distinction between good and evil is a very, very Christian category, which was brought in with the Spanish conquest. So we have various religious traditions in which the good-evil distinction does not seem to be basic to their understanding of the sacred or their understanding of the divine at all.
In fact, that would fall within the concept of hypermorality, which is presented by Bataille. I don't know, for example, literature and evil, where he's trying to push this idea where there isn't good and evil per se, but this hyper-morality that goes beyond the judgment. But there's this constant destruction, consumption, destruction, creation, something that goes beyond it.
In your presentation, you tried to bring together elements of Bataille's philosophy with a possible approach to a sociology of society. That is to say, they have both, his ideas have both philosophical and sociological implications. And here you were focusing on the notion of excess, the notion of expenditure. And I think you were contrasting Bataille's interpretation of the gift with Marcel Mauss. He based his work upon Marcel Mauss's descriptions of the potlatch among the Northwest Coast Indians, but essentially he was offering a different interpretation. Mm-hmm. Because my understanding of Marcel Mauss is that he wished to emphasize the links between people established by the gift and also the balance established in society by the gift. In other words, social order is, as it were, continually reproduced through gift exchange. Whereas, according to your presentation, Bataille's notion of the gift is almost exactly the opposite. The gift is the ultimate expenditure. It is the ultimate move away from balance. It is, and here we get back to questions of good and evil, it seems to be not concerned with relatedness at all. The purpose of economy, the purpose of even of giving is not to establish a relation, but rather to experience and testify to the fact that one has existed. Mm-hmm. The gift only becomes a gift when it is excessive. The gift only becomes a gift when it is disinterested, surprisingly enough. Surprisingly enough.
It is important because disinterest is different because, how can I explain? It's not a disinterest because you like the person, but a disinterest on the other side, like, I don't care, I'm powerful and I have all this, I don't care about it, I'll either give it to you or just throw it, It's a certain nonchalance, kind of thing. And, for example, one of the differences between the interpretation of the gift between Bataille and Mauss is the concept of class struggle, where in Mauss we find this idea where you have a chief who is almost representing his people in the potlatch, whereas in Bataille, to him the potlatch is a way of the chief using the resources that were created by the poorer classes and destroying them, expanding them in a way, not only to show his rival and outdo his rival, but also in a way of showing that he has got the power of over the poorer classes. So there's already this contrast. And even, I mean, how can I explain? For example, Marcel Mauss, not Marcel Mauss, but I use it a bit when he tries and mention his own examples for Potlatch. He gives more violent examples, for example, the Aztecs and the sacrifices on the temples. Mentions from the Potlatch, he keeps on moving towards the two world wars, where he describes them as orgies of expenditure, basically. So the perspective is completely different. But
so violence is not a breakdown of social relationship. Breakdown, violence as in its, particularly in its social form of war, because you distinguished at one point in your lecture between Bataille's concept of natural luxuries and social luxuries. Mm-hmm. Natural violence or social violence are not, as it were, interruptions of human identity or human personality, as they would be within Christian philosophy. Rather, they are can expressions. They are
yes,
pari passu with peaceful gift exchange. They are expressions of human identity.
Put it this way, that is his analysis of history. Let's not forget that Bataille was also influenced by Hegel. So there is this concept of the dialectic, and where war is basically part of the dialectic. But then there is the Bataille who believes in resistance, who believes in revolution, and as I mentioned, where he mentions revolution for the poorer classes, where there's this reversal of potlatch and expenditure. And he also believes in a certain ideal, but he says that this is impossible. I think it's in a cursed chair. I'm not sure if it's in a cursed chair or in visions of excess. He mentions that, for example, America has a responsibility. The United States have a responsibility with all the wealth that they have got. And that their expenditure, their excess resources and energy should be given to the third world countries or poorer countries so as to balance out things. But he himself admits that this is too much of an idealization and that it will never happen. And that probably this excess energy will...
You say war is an expenditure.
Yes, but he also tries to give a more positive manner. But he admits that that's the only way that it works out, and through war, and not through this way.
I just want to clarify one point you made in answer to the question on madness. I understood you as saying that for Bataille, the moment of complete... loss of reason, doing things without a reason. For example, if we do things and are aware of doing things without any reason whatsoever, the purely gratuitous act, almost like the gratuitous murder in André Gide, when you have a totally gratuitous, reasonless act that is akin to madness in our way of thinking, even if technically we would not certify the person mad. It's this lack of reason for doing things, which is madness. For Bataille, that's sovereignty. If you do things without a reason, you are both experiencing yourself, quote unquote, for the first time in your life, but you are also expressing and controlling yourself, strangely enough. Am I correct in saying that for Bataille, doing activities for a reason was a sign of being controlled by some outside methodology? Is that what's at stake here? For example, you contrast the economy of expenditure, the economy of excess, with the economy of production, calculation, and saving. This is basic to your presentation of Bataille. Does this mean that for Bataille, sovereignty is only experienced when we do things without a reason, when we do things not out of calculation, that calculations are an imposition upon us? When we do things according to a rule, any rule, When we do things out of a method of calculation, we are limiting ourselves. We are subjecting ourselves to some social regulation outside of us. Whereas when we do things, the man who does something with no reason at all, gratuitously, is like the man who gives away his wealth. In many societies, this is the ultimate sign of the gentleman, the ultimate act of honor. Here, have it, have it.
Up to a certain extent, yes. I mean, if you one thinks about it, let's forget, you know, sociology, philosophy and stuff like that, in a psychological manner, and maybe you can think about it on a personal level. When things are done with a reason, usually the reasons that are, reasons that are given are the way we were brought up, the way the values that were given to us by society, all these things. Whereas when there is no reason, it's like, I feel like doing it. I'm full stop, that's all. But how can I explain? When I have £10, and I decide that with these £10 I want to invest them. When I'm describing my action, I'm saying, with these £10 I went to the bank, invested them so that then I will receive. But when I say, with these £10 I bought, or I got wasted, there is the I, that big I, which is different to the other. The end becomes the person, the persona himself, even the description of the action per se.
To psychoanalytic notions of the id and the unconscious, no?
Mm-hmm.
Within post-structuralism, there is this emphasis on doing things otherwise, writing outside structures. And madness would be interpreted within this context as being that which is other to reason. Therefore, this whole notion of madness, of expenditure, of things that are not calculated, of things that are not within an economy, could be linked to the unconscious itself, and to that which cannot be said, that which cannot be spoken, that which cannot be articulated, that which is unspeakable or unrepresentable, which obviously links to methods of writing and doing and being otherwise, being outside of certain social structures, being outside of what Lacan maybe calls the symbolic or subjectivity, being outside of language itself, therefore.
No, in fact, I mean, just as we were saying, but I was part of the surrealist movement, which basically one of its dogmas was interpretation of dreams by Freud. So there's this constant thing. And basically, I can't add much. I mean, that's the reasoning behind it.
It's all linked. I see a very clear link between notions such as madness, what Derrida calls writing or the trace,
mm-hmm.
the gift in this context, violence, eroticism, all these others to a certain extent that can only be articulated within by means of another itself and by means of an outside and
by means
something
what?
Different. By means of being other to what is logocentric, phallocentric, to all these metaphysical concepts.
That's the thing. I mean, if you take it from a Derridean perspective, you create yourself by analyzing by seeing the other. So what happens? The structure will show the mad, and why call them mad? Because by calling them mad, basically, you are trying to give this notion of by giving this of invalidity. If someone is mad, there is no logic, there is no value.
In so order basically, to justify your own reason, in order to exclude them as Foucault.
Exactly, precisely. So basically, the structure will try and create the self of its members by showing and taking out the value from the others and by calling them madness.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you go into the realm of madness, you become the self and you look at the structure as the other. And there's this constant playing. And then one could almost say that even the gift is kind of this play of self and other. At one point you are the other, because you are the receiver, and the other point you are the self, because you are the giver. And this constant change.
We're coming back here now to notions of the unspeakable, the overcoming of the limit, the passing of a limit. This has emerged in the discussion tonight in various contexts. You began your presentation by saying that for Bataille, the essential concept which links his economy, his the studies in eroticism, was the notion of the impossible, that which is beyond knowledge. And this suggests to me that what Bataille was looking at, both in his economy and in his historical and his erotic studies, he was looking for a concept of transcendence, which of course is an old, a very, very, very old theme in European philosophy. He was looking at, he was re-studying or reviewing, revisiting, if you will, in contemporary jargon, the ways in which we go beyond ourselves. And this reaches in the point which the last speaker made about madness and the mad person. There is the movement beyond speech. And this seems to be essentially running through Bataille's work, a notion that one experiences reality and humanity when one goes beyond words or formulations.
But I mean, this transcendence is basically his concept of the impossible, where there's this thing, which, as I always mention, it, you cannot call it the ideal world, because the ideal world, there's, you know, like there's a certain conception of what could be ideal, of what could be perfect. No, it's just impossible to. It's a totality which you cannot even imagine. That can we can only come close to through experiencing, to these experiences of sovereignty. To these sovereign experiences, basically, because how can I explain? When there are these strong, strong emotions, like we're mentioning before, artistic emotions, stuff like that, you are part of an energy, a cosmic energy, to put it in this kind of jargon, that you cannot explain yourself, and for that reason, because you cannot explain it, therefore, by not explaining it, you have gone beyond words. And you have already gone beyond the structure, and thus you have become closer to the impossible.
Right, well, thank you very much, François, for what opens up a, I think, a very new and very interesting area for discussion here at the University of Malta. Thank you for what I think to be a very, very well-informed discussion of all kinds of aspects of Georges Bataille and his links with both psychology and structural anthropology. Thank you very much.
You have just listened to a seminar in the Work in Progress series entitled Georges Bataille's Interpretation of Potlatch and the Gift by Françoise Amitte.